If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
Welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore, and you are listening to episode 38 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, if this is your first time listening, please go and check out the earlier episodes of this show and make sure to subscribe so you keep up to date with new episodes as they come out. On this episode, we're going to be doing a franchise crossover, one that we haven't done in a type of episode we haven't done in a minute. So it's good to revisit this kind of format for this episode. And we are going to be taking a look at Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. All right, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, the latest MCU film. It's coming out a little later from its theatrical release. I had a necessary celebration-induced break from the show. So ordinarily, this probably would have come out in, let's say, late May, maybe earlier June. But, you know, this will be coming out around the time that the movie will be coming out on Disney Plus. So this is still hashtag relevant content. So we're going to be looking back at that movie and talking about some of the Star Wars connections to it. As I kind of talked about on the previous episode when I teased this topic, a lot of the things that I do on the show, a lot of the episodes on this show, a lot of the topics are to one degree or another planned in advance or things that I'm thinking about for a while. I'm going to talk about this at some point, or they are topics that have a relatively long runway and I spend a decent amount of time prepping them to get them out. This was one of those episodes that fell in the category of just the Eureka apple falling from the tree and hitting you on the head things, where I went to see the movie and I'm like, man, I gotta talk about this on the show, and then just kind of slapped together an episode idea and decided to go with it. And I am very, very fortunate that my guest agreed to join me on this rather spontaneous decision here. So it is a returning guest. Since I'm talking about Doctor Strange, there's only one person I could have asked back on the show to delve back into this topic. He is, of course, the host of Octo Radio, a co-host of A Rewatch Between Worlds and the One and Done Film Club, the Wong of Star Wars podcasting. I don't know exactly what that means. Alden Diaz, welcome back to the show.
I am flattered to be called the Wong of anything in my life. His evolution has just been delightful. That means I get the top job.
Yes.
It means that I seem pretty secure with myself. I get to hang out with Abomination and karaoke with Shang-Chi. Like, that sounds like a great time. But really, it's great to be back. I have been really looking forward to this. Like you said, this is a little bit of ways from the film's release because of celebration and stuff. But even while there was a little bit of Doctor Strange in the back of my mind. There was a Doctor Strange cosplayer, which was hilarious, at Star Wars Celebration, trying to get back to the right universe. Was the whole gimmick there. It's been a great time for this character and for the MCU. So I'm excited to dive in.
Yeah, me too. So for this episode, it's going to be structured a little different than our first Doctor Strange discussion. If folks are listening, have listened to that one where we were talking about the first Doctor Strange movie, but right before Spider-Man No Way Home came out. And I'm sure probably No Way Home is going to factor in to some degree into this conversation, because there's some important Doctor Strange evolution stuff that happened in there. Mm-hmm. So usually, you know, these franchise episodes kind of take one of two forms. So the one form is the one of the first Doctor Strange episode, which is, you know, we take a chunk of media, you know, like we take a movie like that and we kind of walk through it and then kind of talk about the Star Wars connections. For this one, I'm going to do a slightly different format. It's similar to some of the other ones that I have done in this genre, which is really we're going to be using Multiverse of Madness as a kind of springboard for looking at a particular thematic connection with Star Wars. So, and, you know, to introduce the audience to what we're going to be doing is I really want to take a look at the theme of temptation in Star Wars, because it's obviously a theme that's a really important part of the story of Multiverse of Madness, because a lot of that story for both what happens to Doctor Strange and his particular arc in that movie, and then also what happens with Wanda Maximoff and her story, has to do with the temptation and the allure of darkness. Because, of course, the big thing that we have there is, you know, you've got Wanda on the one hand, she is using the Darkhold that she gets at the end of WandaVision from Agatha, and she is trying to use that and the powers that she learns from it in order to be reunited with her lost children. And then we also see over the course of the movie various Doctors Strange in different multiverses making use of the Darkhold in different contexts, and including our sort of main own Doctor Strange eventually using it in the climax of the movie with varying consequences, as we'll talk about. And so I think that idea, the notion of using dark and forbidden powers and the allure of that, or the allure of kind of secret forbidden knowledge, I think is something that really runs through that entire story, and is of course something that really runs through a lot of Star Wars. And so what I wanted to do for this conversation is sort of connect some of that stuff in that movie to some of the kind of major examples and major characters where we get to see that in Star Wars. So I think a good place probably to start in the Star Wars context, in this theme kind of moving chronologically, would be to start with the story of Anakin. Because I think that's probably the most prominent example that we get in Star Wars of the story of temptation and the pitfalls and the consequences that come with that. So I think where I want to start this off with us talking about it is, you know, one of the things that often comes up in the kind of analysis of Anakin's story, and you often see this in like, this sort of pops up in kind of Twitter discourse every so often. Like we had one of these like a few months, like a few weeks or maybe like a month or two back. I don't remember how long it was. There's always this kind of like conversation that comes up every so often about like who or what is to blame for Anakin's fall to the dark side.
Right.
And so you'll get like people are like, oh, it was like Padme. And it was like, oh, it was Mace Windu, or it was like whatever. And like you have this kind of conversation about it. So I'm curious, as a kind of starting off point for this conversation, like how do you understand or conceptualize how and why Anakin turns?
It's a really, really delicate balance in terms of Star Wars, right? Because, and I feel like I just talked about this in a positive way with the light side in terms of the cosmic force, because the force, I firmly believe, does not make anyone do anything. But at the same time, it does present these choices. It does present these pivot points. Mace Windu would perceive them as shatter points. It's this whole idea of everything brings you to the next opportunity to make the right or wrong call. But the dark side does have that added seductive element. It does have that, of course, quicker and easier element. So it's an interesting balance with Anakin, because whether it's Anakin, whether it's Kylo Ren, whether it's any of these dark side users, Count Dooku is another one for, with his own motivations, you always want to, I think, analyze it and take it in with the honesty and the accountability of choice always there, ever present, hanging above them, but also with the understanding that the specific power with which they are surrendering to, there comes an element of, well, it gets easier. And then it gets easier. I mean, to bring in another franchise that we're not talking about today that we could probably do three more hours on with Batman, his whole rationalization for not killing just the Joker. When people say, why not just him? And he says, well, because it'll just be just him that day. And then it'll get easier to do the next one. And then the next one. And then the next one. And that's sort of how I view the dark side, where it's not possessing Anakin Skywalker, but it creates that slippery slope initially. And then it makes it slipperier and slipperier, and it just becomes this swan dive into darkness, Star Trek into darkness even, where it just – no, not really. Actually, nothing to do with that. But it just has this this energy of, okay, much like Wanda with the Darkhold is not magically creating this motivation for Wanda. The motivation is inherent in Anakin Skywalker. More to blame than just the pull of the dark side of the force. Because again, everyone feels the pull to the dark side of the Force. Look at that Yoda arc that I always say is my favorite in Clone Wars, where he has to confront the shadow apparition of himself, that shadow version of Yoda. Mace Windu and his entire lightsaber form of, I say Vapad, some people say Vapad, that is brushing and dancing with darkness at all times. So it's always going to be there. But it's the specific experience things like slavery, like the separation from the parent, like being older and having trauma and having no way to work through it, that creates a relationship with that darkness that facilitates his turn. So I think that it is based on Anakin Skywalker and who he is more so than it is on the dark side, in the same way that I think that Wanda's choices organically come from WandaVision, organically come from what she wanted. It's all about the individual, but you know, it's a difficult conversation when there is a clear addiction metaphor and when there is a clear corrupting force, no pun intended, when you look at dark side users versus light side users, whether it's the eyes, whether it's the flesh, the teeth, you know, there is sort of an ambiguity there in terms of what drives them. But I don't think that it is easy to say, well, it was the dark side that made them do it. That's not built into the parable of Star Wars, you know, where the whole thing is a morality play.
Yeah. You bring up some really good points that I want to sort of connect and kind of build on. So, you know, you bring up that whole point about agency, and I think that's really important. And you had a really good thread about that on Twitter, I think like right around the time that Doctor Strange came out. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about in the context, I think, of Wanda. And, you know, you talk about this idea of, you know, choice and about how these, like the temptations of the dark side or the darkness, I can't make you do or not do certain things. And, you know, it brings to mind, and, you know, we will get to Rebels kind of chronologically in this context of the conversation, but it makes me think of what the Bendu tells Kanan about the Sith holocron.
Mm-hmm.
When Kanan comes to him and says, like, I need you to take this. It is turning my apprentice evil. And he's like, well, an object can't make you good or evil. I think, right. Actually, I have the quote. Where is it? It's right here in my notes. You know, where he says, the temptation of power, forbidden knowledge, even the desire to do good can lead some down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that you see in the context of even someone like Wanda, but then also someone like Anakin, where you can see the understandable, the relatable motives and how that leads into bad places. Because I think about like how much of Anakin's turn is really kind of rooted in what at least begin as positive or good-natured traits that end up kind of twisted over time.
Right.
Where like, particularly his instinct and his desire to help people. Like I think about, you know, in Phantom Menace, when Qui-Gon and company are there and, you know, he's talking about the ship and he says, I can help, I can fix anything. And so like you see it in there. And in that context, it's like, oh, here's this 10-year-old kid and he's being really selfless and he just wants to help these people that he met 5 minutes ago. And then you move into Attack of the Clones and you get that conversation with Padme right after he's killed the Tusken Raiders. Mm-hmm. And the lead into that is he's fixing something in the Lars homestead. And he talks about it like, I'm good at fixing things, always has been. And then that's the lead into why couldn't I save my mom?
Right. I mean, and that is, I mean, not to jump to, there's going to be an ongoing theme here, just like the first Doctor Strange episode where I just say things and then I'm confident that they're somewhere on Devore's notes, even though I haven't seen them. And I swear it's not a bit. I really haven't. But how much of Anakin Skywalker's reflections on being able to fix things is the Multiverse of Madness metaphor of holding the knife?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is so baked into Stephen Strange's perspective on his own journey and Wanda's, what they have in common. You get an expanded backstory for Strange in this movie that is, I think, really key to understanding why he is the way he is in terms of losing his sister in childhood and how that pushed him into wanting to be this surgeon that could save anyone. So the desire for control, the desire to be able to fix things as a trauma response is so baked into Anakin Skywalker. And the fact that he's proven right to certain degrees, it's not just folly in terms of Anakin. I mean, he became the hero of the Republic because of his ability. He was able to successfully complete all these missions. He was able to, save R2-D2, even when people said, no, it's such a droid, give up on him. No, he saved him. He was able to rise to the occasion and train Ahsoka. He was able to prove himself time and time and time again. And it's the fact that every single one of those victories builds up his own, like, mythologizing of his own abilities as chosen one, as this kid that loved to fix things, that adds to his fall, because there is that element of hubris there too. But it's not hubris just because he was he wasn't some arrogant kid.
Yeah,
he was a giving kid, a humble child, you know, who was brilliant but wanted to embrace community and wanted to, you know, you see it in Phantom Menace of bringing these strangers in because there's going to be a sandstorm. You know, they need shelter, they need something to eat, you know, they need help. He is all of these things at once, and trying to be all of them to the fullest and not accepting his own fallibility is right there with the power of the actual dark side in terms of what drags him down.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that impulse that we've been talking about, that kind of psychological need to fix and to help people, and sort of, as you were talking about, combined with his kind of own hubris about his own abilities, I think really kind of leads into this conversation about, like, what leads him to the dark side. Because, you know, to get back to that starting point, and my own thoughts about this is, like, the conversation about this, or, like, the discourse about Anakin's turn, like, always comes down to, like, is it an individual choice? Like, is it his actions or his decisions to blame for the turn? Or is it this larger thing, whether it's like the Jedi, however you want to define it? Mm-hmm. And for me, always, I think, like, when looking at the text of the story, I think the story is trying to say it's both and.
Yeah.
It is both an individual failure, a series of bad decisions that Anakin makes, and it is this institutional failure in which it is happening that allows it to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it has to be that perfect storm. You need that perfect storm, and you need that person that can perceive all of the elements at once, which is Sheev Palpatine, to be able to say, oh, well, let's pray on this. Let's press this issue. Let's raise this question. It has to be all those things. It has to be that right time, that right place. So I think that, you know, anyone that attributes Anakin Skywalker's fall to one thing is just patently incorrect. Like, it has to be this time, these people, this situation, being not just a child of slavery, but a child of immense conflict, interpersonal conflict, war. It's all of these things. He can never be the husband he wants to be, the Jedi he wants to be, the student, the brother, the mentor. None of those things ever feel complete to him. And it's that type of person that will fall down that path much quicker. And, you know, not to jump too far ahead, but when you look at Wanda has all those things too. You know, she was never able to have the family life that she wanted to be, and therefore couldn't be the daughter she wanted to be because they grew up in wartime.
Yeah.
She couldn't be the sibling in a normal way because they were radicalized. They were always fighting, and then they were experiments. She couldn't be the Avenger she wanted to be. She couldn't be the mother she wanted to be, the wife she wanted to be. It's all those things that get taken from you or corrupted that make it easy to make that choice.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think in the context of Anakin's story, I think you get a couple of examples of just that kind of synergy between the individual and the institution, that kind of perfect storm. Because, like, you see an example of, like, let's say the massacre of the Tuskens, where you have, on the one hand, you have the individual context of Anakin having this particular reaction to death of his mother and then killing not just the men, but the women and the children too. But then you see, on the one hand, like, you've got Yoda sensing this, and he has the whole, like, pain, suffering, death, I feel. And then it's like, but does anyone do anything? Like, not really.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's Ki Adi Mundi. Your thoughts dwell on your mother. It's like, yeah, can we talk about it?
Yeah. And, like, you get these these moments of, like, I'm particularly thinking about, you know, because it came out not too long ago at the time of this recording, and I listened to it not too long ago, but I think about the book Brotherhood, mm-hmm. where you get, on the one hand, in that book, you get the scene where Anakin tells Palpatine about the massacre, and he confides in him in that. And then you get in that book, just as you get in the moment in Revenge of the Sith, you get Palpatine kind of validating his response to the massacre. And then you get kind of towards the end, after the mission wraps up, you have this moment where Obi-Wan wants to talk to Anakin. I can't remember, like, what about specifically. Like, maybe it was in the context of, like, attachments or Padme or something. And he's like, nah, you know what? I'll talk about it another time. And he just kind of passes on it.
Yeah.
I forget the exact context of what was happening. But, like, you get these moments where different Jedi are like, oh, okay, like, I should really address this, or I'm kind of picking up on some bad things. And then they just kind of coast.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always the, well, there's next time. Well, there's next time, because they can, there's no world where they conceivably see a downfall. There's always going to be, later on when the situation is solved, because they're the Jedi. And that's hubris, you know, it's the belief. You see it in Brotherhood with Obi-Wan, specifically on the Padme issue of, should I bring this up to the council? Maybe not at the right time. Once Cato Nemoidia is solved, then I'll bring it up. Or maybe I'll talk to Anakin myself. Actually, I don't really know which of those is better. I'll figure it out another time. Even though that's considerate and he's trying to work it out in his head, there's nothing wrong with that. The idea that, well, we can always bury the feeling and do the work, it's not necessarily healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think all of that really comes to a head in Revenge of the Sith, because you have these two moments that I think side by side are really worth understanding together. Because you get, of course, you know, it begins with, you've got Anakin having all the visions about Padme and dying in childbirth and all that. And then you see him at the beginning of the movie, and he at first tries to do the correct Jedi thing, which is he goes to see Yoda. Mm-hmm. And then you get what I've always referred to as the shitty Yoda therapy session, where Anakin is trying to the extent that he can, open up to Yoda about what he's feeling and what's going on. And then Yoda's response is, you know, train yourself to let go.
Yeah. Yeah. Not his best work.
Yeah.
Not his shining moment of his career.
Yeah. And it's a great scene because it establishes early on there that the Jedi don't have the answers that Anakin's looking for. Yoda is giving him the textbook Jedi answer, which is, you need to learn to let go, accept that everyone becomes part of the Force, mourn them, do not miss them, do not. And then Anakin's sitting there like, nah, this is not going to work.
Right. Right. And there's an inherent hypocrisy there too, which is another theme that ties into your overall question of why Anakin Skywalker's downfall, and why this episode connecting to Multiverse of Madness, because hypocrisy is so key there too, where when Wanda says things like, you say this, but you also do this, that's hypocritical. She's right.
Yes.
She's empirically, unequivocally correct. And so when Anakin, I mean, we're watching, not to date this episode too much, but at the time of this recording, we're in the midst of Obi-Wan Kenobi, the series, and Obi-Wan has more than one moment of saying that he misses X individuals, whether it's, you know, the Jedi Order that he compares to the new family that he got, or whether it's the two instances of Padme without saying Padme, but, you know, that he misses her. And it's just that lingers over things. And it's like, isn't that contradictory to the advice that you were passing down to the Chosen One? It's like you need to have a healthy way to miss, a healthy way to mourn, a healthy way to even wish that someone was still around in a non-possessive way. And that's the line. But they didn't either have the willingness, the will to do this nuanced conversation. They just made it so cut and dry because they were distracted, arrogant, stuck in their ways because of the generational gap. Because as much as we love Yoda, it's like your centuries of life changes your perspective inherently on this kid who, because people forget that when Anakin Skywalker falls, he's only 22.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, like, that's, he's a young man. He's younger than we are doing this podcast. He's a kid, you know, on Earth terms, he just started drinking last year. And it's a lot to shoulder for anybody, especially with that pressure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I even, you know, I touched on it a bit, you know, when you were talking about Obi-Wan and, you know, the failure to address issues. Like I talked about it in the previous episode, I look back at Attack of the Clones for the anniversary, and I sort of touched on that moment that the two of them have while guarding Padme, where Anakin is talking about how he's losing sleep and he keeps dreaming about his mother. And then Obi-Wan just has that line of dreams pass in time. That's not helpful.
Yeah. And I've always loved the dreams pass in timeline, because you can tell, and part of it is Ewan just being a fantastic actor, that he's attempting to have a tenderness.
Yeah.
Like, he is saying it in a soft way, and he's trying something. Again, it's who is the father Anakin needs, you know, tying back to Dave Filoni's now much celebrated, as it should be, mini speech in Disney Gallery, The Mandalorian, where he's talking about what is the Duel of the Fates actually about? What is the what fates? Who's dueling? What are the forces at work? And it's the idea that Qui-Gon is the father Anakin needs. Obi-Wan is the father Anakin ends up with. But Obi-Wan sees it as a brotherhood, and Anakin sees it more that way. When they're walking into the Outlander Club, he says, you know, you're the closest thing I have to a father. Like, and Obi-Wan's not really receptive to that. He doesn't respond to that with any sort of particular warmth or attention. So he's giving the advice that would work for him. Obi-Wan is a much more methodical and measured and calculated individual than Anakin is. If the roles have been reversed and it was, or even take it back on the timeline, maybe there were days where Obi-Wan was having dreams of Satine or something, and Qui-Gon said dreams pass in time. That kind of thing works for Obi-Wan Kenobi. It doesn't work for Anakin Skywalker, because Obi-Wan Kenobi came up with family, whether they were found or not. When they were found, the Jedi, Anakin Skywalker remembers life. And what he misses about it is Shmi, but he can't miss Shmi also without thinking about slavery and pain. So dreams pass is not going to fly for him.
Yeah. And, you know, it is that kind of institutional feel of the Jedi to give Anakin some sort of outlet or some sort of means to deal with his inner struggle that creates the avenue ultimately for Palpatine. And so when I was talking about Revenge of the Sith and the two scenes side by side, I talked, you know, one of them is the shitty Yoda therapy session, as I called it. And then, of course, the second one is the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise. Mm-hmm. It is the opera scene, which is just this, of course, you know, it's a scene, of course, it's been talked about many, many times and dissected many, many times. But, you know, you've got that whole kind of two act structure to it, where like act one is Palpatine trying to go with the stick approach, where he's kind of both sidesing the Sith and the Jedi. I'm like, why aren't they all really the same? Aren't they both about pursuing power and this kind of selfish end? And then Anakin does all the pushback. He's like, no. The Sith are thinking inwards only about themselves. The Jedi just try to help others. They're selfless. And then it's the second act, the carrot approach, where he's going like, well, here is this story about this guy who had these powers. And that is where you get the temptation part starting to come in, where, you know, that scene kind of closes with that part that, like, a lot of Revenge of the Sith has gotten kind of meme to death, but it actually has a lot of weight to it, which is it possible to learn this power not from a Jedi? And of course, the significance there is it is Palpatine trying to say the Jedi don't have the answers. You went to Yoda and you got the Jedi answer, but I have the answers.
Right. And it's giving the piece of information that preys perfectly on the insecurity at hand, which is, as we talked about, you know, it's this character that wants to be all these things and can't be fulfilled in any of them. It's like then hit the predator in the situation with Palpatine can see, oh, what he needs is the easy fix all scenario. He needs to be presented with a plan, with an option, with a path that is so, you know, catered to him, that is so that would be so easy and perfect, that it seems like the good option. You know, how could you not? It's truly, truly, you know, biblical devil stuff. You know, in terms of preying on the innocent. You know, the you know, road to hell paved with good intentions. All that classic stuff. And I think about that with the Darkhold too, in terms of the context of of Wanda in terms of, I think that, you know, there's a fundamental disagreement amongst Marvel fans and genre fans of, it was WandaVision the end of an arc, and I didn't see it as the end of an arc. I saw it as the end of that part of the arc. She acknowledged that Westview was wrong, you know, that what happened there was wrong. And then she's leaving the town with her hoodie on and they're all staring at her like a monster because what she did was monstrous, intentional or otherwise. And it's not at all calling Wanda a monster. It's saying that that was a dark deed. And she is willing to let go of that representation of Vision, that representation of the kids. But that creates new traumas. That creates new pain. She didn't leave Westview and say, well, suddenly I'm over Vision's loss. No, now you've given him up again. And children. And these, and Billy and Tommy, these people that, that changed your life. And you gave them up again. And you still haven't grieved the Thanos conflict and everything. So her Darth Plagueis the Wise is witnessing what Agatha can do. Is knowing that there is this book. Is now knowing what she is. And she's being told, well, you're this and you're this and you're this in terms of the Scarlet Witch connecting to Anakin with the Chosen One. And it's like, well, what if I took hold of that? What if I was able to do something with it that would, maybe I don't have to, you can understand I should get there. You know, I'm not going to hurt innocence anymore. I'm going to make it a solo quest to find my kids. And I'm going to use this. But that makes it easier to make the next choice and the next choice, which goes back to the beginning of this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And you see that, you know, you see that kind of spiral happen with Anakin. So to get to that point about, like, as you just mentioned, about the good intentions and the good nature getting twisted. And you see that with, of course, one, his ultimate turn to the dark side in the hope that he's going to able to save Padme. But then you even get that whole conversation between the two of them on Mustafar, where Padme is confronting him with the killing of the younglings and what he's become and decisions made. And you see the way that he immediately tries to go into the fix it mode. And he's like, well, I'm more powerful than the Chancellor. I can overthrow him. We can rule the galaxy. He's immediately going to like, okay, here's a problem. I got to fix it now.
Right. Right. Yeah. He's grasping. Like it's almost like a panic mode, you know, even in Hayden's performance, you know, which I think is great details, the stuttering, the, I can overthrow him. Like things like that. It's like he's coming up for air a little bit, but not enough for any clarity. Yeah. And then it becomes doubling down because he feels cornered and he sees Obi-Wan on the ramp. And then it's okay. Any chance of him seeing any wrongdoing is now extinguished.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, this is, you know, this whole like conversation with that, with Anakin, and then also the context of the story of Darth Plagueis the Wise is one of the reasons why, and we can probably get that more into this towards the end when we get to, you know, the sequel trilogy era and stuff. It is one of the reasons why I love the decision to return Palpatine in the final act. And it is why one of those things that, like, no one will convince me was a bad, like, you know how there are those like Twitter posts every so often that's like, what Star Wars thing do you defend like this?
Yeah.
Like, for me, that is always Palpatine's return.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, because it links back thematically so well, and it becomes this kind of through line back to so many of the themes of the prequels about temptation, about the allure of these powers, the allure of darkness.
Absolutely. I mean, the light side lets go, the dark side doesn't.
Yeah.
It makes sense that there's a changing guard of light side heroes, that it's a generational thing and everyone opens the door for everyone else. Meanwhile, on the dark side, there are new faces, but much like in the real world, you know, in that real world George political metaphors, it is always going to be the same crusty old powers that are clinging. And by, you know, he goes through these different forms. Like, you track the physical degeneration of Sheev Palpatine from a man when you meet him with Senator Palpatine, all the way through to the Emperor, who is this being of considerable darkness and considerable deformity and corruption. And then by the end, I wish they had left the line in. The Ian McDiarmid said that they shot that line where he says, Kylo says, are you a clone? And he says, more than a clone, less than a man. Like that, it's not a criticism, but God, I wish that line was in there.
Yes.
Cause that's exactly what he is. He's a rotting clone corpse, and he would still prefer to be that than to just let go.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it was the guys on Force Center who talked about this, about like how, like, for Palpatine, and again, like, we're kind of jumping ahead to Rise of Skywalker, but it's fine. You know, like, the way that Palpatine kind of closes the loop almost on his own master, like, he becomes the man who got so powerful that the only thing he was afraid of was losing his power.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he becomes Plagueis.
And it's what he accuses the Jedi of being, too.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that, and again, we'll come back to Rise of Skywalker, but that's just a little tease for that. Yeah, it's one of many reasons why I love that executive decision to bring him back in the final act. But yeah, so we kind of talked about Anakin's story a little bit there, and the role that temptation has kind of played in his particular context. I think sort of moving along the Star Wars chronology, that, like, the next person that I kind of want to talk about and dig into a little bit is Ezra Bridger.
Hmm.
And because I think he has some really, really compelling moments throughout the show Rebels where he is dealing with this. Like, we see it early on in season one, his struggles with fear. We get, you know, the first visit to the Lothal Temple where he has all the visions of, first it's the Grand Inquisitor killing Kanan, and then it's the conversation on the ghost where all the crew members are kind of talking down on him and pitying him and all of that. So we get those moments. We get the whole thing with the Fear Nox where he is controlling them. And, you know, it's sort of, for him, it kind of comes to a head and climaxes at the end of season two with Twilight of the Apprentice, mm-hmm. where you get, you know, on the one hand, the introduction of Maul, and like Maul kind of becomes his Palpatine figure before Palpatine literally becomes the Palpatine figure.
Yeah.
And the way that Maul is trying to kind of coax him to turn him into a kind of pseudo apprentice to use him to get the holocron out of the temple.
Right.
And then the relayed action, which is the defeat of Kanan and his blinding. And the way that, again, in a lot of, like, very similar to Anakin, that feeling of like, oh, I failed in this context. I need to become stronger, more powerful in order to protect my friends.
Right. Always to protect, always to, he pleads to Yoda, like, how do we win? How do we fight? How do, you know, can they be beat? We need to destroy them. And all extremely relatable motivations, all like very accessible in human motivations. And then having Maul there too. I mean, because Maul feeds into that perfectly, because he is, you know, he's, you know, no longer Darth, just Maul, that whole transition. But how he is also in a similar place of how do I destroy these people that have used me, tossed me aside, and I've been stranded. And Maul represents the idea of passing down trauma.
You know, yeah.
He cannot, he can't break the cycle. He will never know peace. Even on his dying day, in his last breath, he's talking about vengeance.
Yes.
He will avenge us. He's a tragic character, but the perfect one for Ezra Bridger to be listening to.
Yes. And, you know, somehow I have not thought about this until this particular moment as you were talking about it. Like, there is, in so many ways, like, a lot of times this happens in Star Wars, characters kind of mirroring one another. And there is kind of, at the outset, a kind of mirror between Ezra and Maul in the sense of, like, these are both kind of strays. You've got Ezra on the one hand, who lost his parents and he was living on the streets for a long time. He was, what is he called? Like, it's not a Lothal rat, but there's, what is the expression? Oh my God, I'm blanking on it.
Oh, it's not Scrum Rat, right?
I think it is Scrum Rat. That's right.
He might
use
Scrum Rat from Solo. Or
yes.
From Rebels, later using Solo.
Yeah. So this kid who has all this experience of kind of being on his own and trying to figure things out. And then Maul similarly being this one who was, you know, I was cast aside and all that, and kind of surviving on his own. But then, of course, from there, the paths diverge, as you kind of talked about, where Ezra is able to forge this new family and then kind of ultimately move ahead, whereas Maul is, yeah, he's sort of stuck in this cycle and can't break it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we get, I've already sort of, you know, I touched on it towards the beginning of the episode, like, we get that great kind of season three opener where you get to see Ezra tapping into the darkness of the Sith holocron and using it again. He's winning all these missions. He's completing all of these things. And in his brain, that kind of rationalizes it because you're getting the results.
And because he's getting a greater picture of how those things are fitting into the whole of good, you know, as they are no longer just the Ghost Crew, they find out about the overall movement. So yeah. That's on his mind too. And so he's not only having all these intimate victories or these one-off mission victories, but he has a grand picture of his capacity to help.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, there Kanan trying to warn him about, like, yes, you can get the quick and easy results, mm-hmm. but then what's the longer term repercussions?
Yeah.
And again, I think that's something that we see, you know, to connect back to Doctor Strange. Like, you see that a little bit, particularly in the context of Strange, or, well, really, like, the Stranges, the multiple Stranges we get.
Right.
Where, like, on the one hand, you get the Strange of the Illuminati universe, where, like, he uses the Darkhold to beat Thanos, and they get that. But then it's like, oh, he's become too dangerous. We got to get rid of him.
Right.
Or you get the, I don't know, like, I don't know if he technically counts as Sinister Strange, like the Three-Eye Strange that he meets, I guess. So
not to take us down that aside, but I will clarify that.
Yeah.
So the Sinister Strange that we see in Multiverse of Madness, that is in the haunted house version of the Sanctum, yeah. is not the What If Strange.
Yes.
So just for listeners, like, he is Sinister Strange. Strange and What If is Strange Supreme, and then Illuminati Universe Strange is Supreme Strange. It is very confusing. I hate that they use the word Supreme twice for those versions. But yeah, I think that even Cumberbatch had to do an interview where he's like, no, What If's its own thing. This dark one is our dark one. So it's a whole thing. But yeah, if people are listening were wondering, there's your sort of little auditory, audible cheat sheet.
Exactly. See, this is why I have the experts on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I am.
And so, yeah, like, you know, he meets the Sinister Strange and he talks about, like, how he used the Darkhold, and he has that line about, like, it exacts a heavy toll.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we even see that with the main universe Strange that we know, where he ends up using it in order to ultimately defeat Wanda. But then we get that kind of ambiguous cut ending where he's back in his universe, but then he's got the third eye. And so right. that kind of leaves you with the question of, like, well, what does that mean for him moving forward?
Right.
And so, yeah, it sort of connects to that notion of the dark side in Star Wars, where, like, as Yoda talks about an empire, like, quicker, easier, more seductive. It gets you the results in the short term.
Right.
In the long term, it has all these repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I think is so compelling about Ezra's story, and, you know, this comes up in the context of other characters that we're going to talk about further along on the timeline, is that, you know, he faces the temptation of the darkness, but then he's ultimately able to overcome it, where, you know, he has, even after he kind of abandons the Sith holocron, you still have this Maul being this kind of literal and metaphorical shadow that follows him all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
Really, until Ezra's faith is kind of ultimately broken in Twin Sons, once right. he sort of figured out that he's being used by Maul
right.
in this way. And then, of course, we get the moment in the series finale where he confronts Palpatine, and Palpatine, much like he did with Anakin, dangles out that carrot of, you can be reunited with your parents. This is what you deserve. You just got to open this up.
Right. And beautifully, Ian McDiarmid is able to do his prequel performance again, because yeah. it's the holographic image of an unchanged Palpatine, which is such a great touch.
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the, again, this is like a little bit of a side, but it is connected to this. Like, that's just one of my favorite little effects details in Star Wars, the way that, yes, like, at the beginning, he is the Chancellor Palpatine, the unscarred and undeformed. And then once Ezra brings down the temple and he comes out, there's the moment where, like, the hologram is crackling in between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ultimately rests on Sidious.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think, like, you see that evolution of Ezra, where he's ultimately able to, on the one hand, he's able to let go, ultimately, of this thing that he wanted most, which is to be reunited with his parents. And he's sort of able to overcome, ultimately, that sort of temptation of the pull of the darkness.
Yeah.
Which is also an arc and a kind of journey of the next person that I want to talk to moving forward along in the timeline, and that's Luke.
Mm.
Because I think Luke has a bunch of experiences that is over the course, particularly of the original trilogy. Maybe we can even kind of extend it past the original trilogy to some of the stuff in the more sequel trilogy period. So, you know, of course, you get first in Empire, you get the all the stuff on Dagobah with the cave.
Right.
And Yoda's line about, or their exchange about, what's in there, only what you bring with you, telling him not to bring in the weapons, and then he brings in the weapons. And that kind of, the confrontation with his, the doppelganger, which, you know, you brought up the example of, you know, from Clone Wars of Yoda on Warband. Mm-hmm. It's again, this kind of recurring motif in Star Wars, that sort of externalized version of yourself.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That is the composite of all of your fears and insecurities.
Right.
And
you have to confront that. even if it's not physically a representation of you. I mean, even like Cal Kestis with the Jaro vision that he sees that attacks him, or Rey with Dark Rey, where it's like it's you, but it also isn't you, and there's clear differences. But whatever that needs to be for the character, it manifests exactly as it needs to, which is so key to understanding from the viewer perspective what your hero's insecurities even are, which we see, you know, we mentioned these strangers, which we see across the different iterations of Doctor Strange.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, again, with Luke, what kind of happens time and time again, and it's this sort of, it's this thing that he constantly, I think, in his story is coming back to and sort of dealing with, is this notion of going, starting from the good motivations, and then that kind of leading him astray. Because, of course, the thing that gets him to cut off his training with Yoda is him having the vision of Han and Leia, and he wants to go help and save his friends because he thinks they're going to die. And Yoda's trying to convince him, you got to stay with the training. You know, what will happen with your friends is going to happen. You need that kind of acceptance of fate that Yoda is trying to instill in him. And of course it doesn't work. And then he suffers the consequences of that in his confrontation with Vader. And, you know, when you lead into, I think, like, Return of the Jedi. Return of the Jedi is like, it's so interesting in this context of Luke's story, because, you know, we talk about Luke and his confrontation of darkness in Jedi, and we kind of talk about it mainly in the context of the end of the movie.
Right.
Which we'll get into, which is all the stuff in the throne room and all that. But it's really this kind of through line through the entire movie, because he's really kind of, you see him from the jump of the movie when he comes in, he's kind of already, there's this sense of he's touching the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
He walks in the Jabba's palace, he's dressed in black, he force chokes the Gamorreans.
Yeah. I mean, he's outright threatening to destroy Jabba.
Yes. Yeah. It's very confrontational with Jabba.
He pulls a blaster on him. You know?
Yes.
Had it worked, he would have shot him.
Yeah. When they're on the sail barge, you know, on the one hand, it is trying to escape from all these folks who are attacking you and you're trying to save their friends, but there's a lot of Luke there being attack, attack, attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back to that line from Yoda and Empire, like, a Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never attack. And then seeing the way that Luke is trying to get everybody out of the situation on Tatooine, it is in this very kind of offensive fashion.
Yep, absolutely.
And so, you know, when he goes back to Dagobah and he's talking to Yoda, I mean, like, I think Yoda, in his conversation, like, I think there's to some degree he is seeing some of that. I think he is sensing some of that Luke is in this very precarious place, which is why in his dying moments, he is trying to reiterate a lot of those lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's talking about the idea of, once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny. Actually, let's talk about that line. and that notion. Like, what do you think about that? Because that's an interesting, because that really also, again, to connect to the Doctor Strange of it all, that's an interesting line.
No, I mean, the forever dominate your destiny is the root of the dark side, right? I mean, that line to me is so essential to every practitioner of the dark side of the Force in their own unique way. It is what we talked about with Ezra, with brushing against it, but being able to make the right choice. It is what we're talking about with Luke, particularly in Jedi, hacking down on Vader, brushing with anger, embracing it is what's, you know, is what carries him to the victory in the duel. But the emotional victory has to be in not surrendering to that, because once you do, again, it gets easier and easier and easier. And that's exactly the line that I fixated upon with Wanda. Forever will it dominate your destiny, because you got into it for good reasons. You got into it because you didn't want to do this Westview thing anymore, and you isolated yourself and you thought that you could just go off by yourself and make it work. But it began to dominate every move, and you start to find out more, and you start to find out more about this multiverse and about this dreamwalking and about how you could possibly do it. And then you stop thinking about consequences. You stop thinking about other people. It continues to blind you in new ways. It continues to dominate you, as the line says. And I think that that becomes so clear with every look that we see at these dark side characters. I mean, I know we haven't brought him up yet, but someone like Ben Solo, Kylo Ren, how even though he was, you could say, maybe not as fully given to the dark side and fully immersed in it as other users were, as he even wanted to be, as he talks about the light being this constant pull, it was dominating his destiny, the prospect of it, the specter of it. And that's why I like that, you know, not to jump all the way to the resolutions of Multiverse of Madness, but that it needs to be brought down at its core. That temptation mm-hmm. needs to be removed, because it will get the people with the best intentions. If that's your Wanda Maximoff, so your Stephen Strange's, whoever that is. And so I think that forever will it dominate your destiny is such a human line. It's such a great warning. It's so universal. It's so accessible. And it's one of my favorite Star Wars ideas.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And you know, you get Yoda there giving him those lessons, talking about how fear and hate and anger, like that these are the paths of the dark side, reiterating a lot of that stuff in Empire. And then he has that line where he talks about, do not underestimate the powers of the Emperor, suffer your father's fate, you will. And I think for the longest time as a viewer of the movie, I always kind of interpreted that line as him alluding to like force powers mm-hmm. of the Emperor, like that the Emperor is just really, really strong. But I think once you, and again, this is the kind of the beauty of the iterative storytelling of Star Wars. Once you kind of recontextualize that in the larger story, I think it's really about the powers of manipulation.
Yeah.
The way that Palpatine can put people in these situations where one, they feel like they're making the right choice, that they're acting for the right reasons, right? Like with Anakin, like you turn to the dark side, but you're doing it to save Padme. Or as he tries to do with Ezra, like you're turning dark, but you're doing it to be reunited with your parents. Or like you're doing this thing for me, but you're doing it for good reason.
Yeah.
But then also, yeah. So on the one hand, the ability to do that, but then also, and I think this is a feature of a lot of the ways that Darksiders in general kind of frame what they're doing or their actions, is putting you in a position where you feel like you don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's like, if we go back to the case of Anakin, that is, Palpatine is putting him in the situation where this is the only way to save her. You have to do this. Yep, do what must be done.
Yeah, I can give you the power to save the ones who love. Yeah, that whole idea. Which is the greatest delivery ever. That entire scene of what's the one that I love? I do eat, don't kill me. Is the greatest. I cannot wait till Celebration 2025, so we could just let Ian have the whole reunion panel to himself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's right there. It's the ideas of taking away choice. It's the ideas of isolation. It's all gaslighting and manipulating. And a line that I love from Rise is Zori Bliss's big theme statement of they win by making you think you're alone.
Yeah.
And with that, and that's not just the First Order. That's the entire dark side. That's the entire forces of evil. That's all antagonists. That is a universal mythic idea for all of these things, even in Marvel. And the idea that the Darkhold or any of these sinister forces like Agatha, I mean, that's what Agatha was doing to Wanda when she unveiled her true self in WandaVision, was making her feel like this singular destructive thing that did not have humanity. You're this and this. You're a prophesized being of evil. You're the most destructive thing ever. The book says so. And that's what happens here with our Star Wars heroes is and Star Wars villains and fallen heroes is this idea that you have to be this. There is no other way. This is the only path. The only way that you can commit to this is by becoming Lord Vader and becoming my apprentice and helping me start an empire. The only way that you can finally have peace of mind is to become Kylo Ren and kill your father. And like, it's always about the absolutes that Obi-Wan mentions in Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, exactly. And so with Luke, once we get to the third act of Jedi, once we start getting to all the stuff that happens on the Death Star too, you get that great little just prelude to all of it, which is their conversation on between Luke and Vader on Endor. And you have on the one hand, we just talked about this notion of agency. Like you see some of that with Vader, where Luke is trying to tell him, I know there's still good in you, come away with me. And Vader is saying, Obi-Wan once thought as you do, and I must obey my master. So that sort of feeling of Vader trying to frame it, saying it's like, I have to do these things, whatever internal pull I might feel towards you. And then you get, in the midst of that, you get that line from Vader where he tells Luke, you don't know the power of the dark side.
Yeah.
And I think when you turn and sort of talk about what happens on the throne room, I think there's a case to be made that Vader's right in that moment. That I think Luke doesn't understand. That I think he goes to confront the Emperor with a certain degree of ignorance about what exactly he is going to face.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Like the idea that all of the key sort of men in his life that remain alive, shout out to Uncle Owen. It's, Obi-Wan, Yoda, Vader, they all in their own way are conveying to Luke that this is the height of evil. Mm-hmm. That you've only brushed with the periphery of what this is. And you need sort of that youthful sort of bravado and bravery and the belief that light will win out. Like you need a certain level of that boyishness to go in and face it so confidently. And that's where you set up those mythic confrontations, but it's the people from the previous age that can convey the no, you don't get it. And that comes from both sides, which is a very interesting aspect of Jedi that not a lot of people talk about. That might be the one thing that unites Obi-Wan, Vader, and Yoda in that trilogy, is that they all agree that this is something that is the height of particular darkness.
Yeah, exactly. And when you talk about that notion of uniting those three characters and the way they kind of interpret the Emperor, interpret the threat, like, there's also in a way that kind of uniting of that feeling of, in terms of how they understand Vader and Anakin, that idea of Anakin is gone, you have to kill him. Like, there's no opportunity for a turn, for a change. Mm-hmm. Like it is this weird moment of kind of agreement or overlap, because you get, of course, when Luke first shows up on the Death Star 2 and he confronts the Emperor, Palpatine telling him, by now you must know that your father can never be turned from the dark side, as will it be with you. And I was like, well, that's pretty much what Obi-Wan and Yoda also believe.
Yeah, there is a cynicism, an earned cynicism, an understandable cynicism coming from Luke's two mentors at this point, And that's part of what's so brilliant about the Kenobi series, of exploring what is the transition point? How do we get from you were my brother, Anakin, I loved you in Revenge of the Sith, to he needs to die. He's yeah. more machine now than man. He needs to go. And if you don't kill him, we've already lost. Yeah. And there's a transition there. And that cynicism infects the light side and infects the perspective of people like Yoda and Obi-Wan, but it comes from somebody who legitimately believes it,
yes.
who revels in it, and that's Palpatine. The whole idea of like, you like your father and now mine, like mm-hmm. all of that are, again, those absolutes of it is easier. That's why Yoda says it's easier, quicker, more seductive, all that, because you're able to not question as much. The dark side doesn't ask as many questions.
Yeah. And, you know, to get back to that idea of Luke that sort of you were talking about the kind of youthful brashness and all that, like you kind of see that again when he first arrives in his initial confrontation with the Emperor, where he talks about, you're wrong, you won't turn me like you did my father, soon I'll be dead and you with me. Luke is going into there thinking that he's got the one up on the Emperor. Mm-hmm. And then once Palpatine were like, no. I know exactly what's happening. I'm the one. It was I who allowed the Alliance to know the location of the shield generator. You know, like all that, you know, and it's once Palpatine reveals the whole game that all of this is happening exactly like he wanted it to happen. And that not only did he intend for the Alliance to come for the strap, oh, also the Death Star is fully armed and operational. And you see immediately just the shift in Luke, who just immediately starts panicking.
Right.
Like the whole body language of him shifting back and forth between looking out at the Alliance fleet and looking at Palpatine. And as soon as that confidence is shattered, it then becomes, you want this, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
The temptation is just there. It just hooks it because, again, there's, you know, going back to that point, all of a sudden now it's like, oh, I could strike him down and I can save my friends.
Yeah, it would be, it would just be this one thing, just this one thing, and we could all be over until that informs how you solve all your problems forever.
Yeah. And, you know, when we talk about, like, it's so interesting because when we talk about all the stuff in the throne room in Return of the Jedi, you know, we obviously, we talk a lot about, and it's important, which is the confrontation with Vader and Luke kind of giving in once the threat to Leia is made and he, you know, he goes on the attack. But really, that's the second time. The first time he gives in is with Palpatine, because Palpatine goads him and he takes the bait.
Yeah, he takes the blade.
Takes his lightsaber.
And he goes for it.
Yeah. So he does it twice in that scene. We often don't talk about the first one. Mm-hmm. But again, it's that it sort of goes back to what you were saying there about like, it becomes easier to do it the first time and then it becomes easier the second time. And then you can dip back into the well that mm-hmm. much easier.
Absolutely.
And so then, yeah, in the crescendo of it, when, you know, when Vader drops a hand, I'm like, sister, mm-hmm. you were talking about this in the latest Octo, but like Vader's delivery of the sister line in Kenobi is just sort of like, I've been watching you, sister.
It's the only way to say it. Sister.
Oh, it's so very good. Yeah. There again, he is lashing out Luke, but again, from that standpoint of, I want to protect the ones I love.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing that gets him onto the precipice. And of course, the really powerful moment when he sees the robot hand of Vader and he looks at his own robot hand and he's seeing how he is on the edge of perpetuating the cycle.
Yeah, it's the same at that point. It's the same motivations. At that point, you've become exactly what Yoda feared you would be, rushing off to Cloud City.
Yeah. But then, of course, the success of Luke and the kind of heroism of Luke is his ability not just to resist the temptation to throw away the lightsaber, but also, and again, this is something that is such a motif in Star Wars, which is this idea of finding the third way.
Right.
Of breaking out of whatever binary box you're put in, where it's like, oh, you either kill Vader or it's all lost. The Emperor's already won. It's like, no, there's one more option.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so key.
Yeah. And I think about that again to kind of connect it to the Doctor Strange of it all. You kind of see that in the climax too. Like a lot of what happens with the plot around America Chavez.
Oh, yeah.
Is you get the opening scene where she's with the Defender Strange and he's like, I got to kill you. This power is like too dangerous to be left around. Only I can control it. And then getting towards the end when Wanda is trying to kill her for the power and she's thinking it has to happen again, but then Strange finding the third way.
Yeah. And it all comes from nonviolence. You know, they're not just going to, you know, kick Wanda's ass until it's over. It doesn't come down to a battle of magic. I mean, the movie sets up Wanda as unbeatable and it commits to it. The only person that can beat Wanda is Wanda. She has to give up. She has to see something that changes her mind, that changes her perspective, that plays on the maternal guilt that is at the root of why she's doing what she's doing. I mean, Wanda's motivation for this is the creation that comes with motherhood, the love that comes with motherhood, the protection, the power, all of those things, that whole nuanced experience. And it's that same nuanced experience that gets her to stop. And that comes from Strange finding that other way, A, with America, and then B, with America and Steven both realizing that she needs to see this and she needs to lay down her sword on her own. I think is a great, it's a great evolution for that franchise of continuing those really elegant third acts, because the first film is the same in terms of finding the other way. It's not just a matter of, you know, that movie doesn't end with them just fighting and killing Caecilius or defeating Dormammu. Like, no, he has to outthink it. He has to be the surgeon. But the difference here with Multiverse of Madness is also giving up control. Steven can't do it. It has to come down to America showing her something that alters the fabric of the themes and of the tension. He has to not be the one holding the knife. America's the one holding the knife, and then America holds the knife to Wanda.
Yeah.
It's all about surrender.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I never thought about the story parallel there until you kind of brought up the scene, which is, yeah, that moment where Wanda is transported to the universe with Bill and Tommy, where she can dreamwalked the one Wanda. Mm-hmm. And she sort of sees them cowering and afraid of her. That in a lot of ways is her looking at the robot hand moment.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you're so right. That's so well said. That is her realizing it forces your character to ask questions about, like, well, what next? You know, if Luke had embraced the darkness in that moment and had looked at the robot hand and said, F it, and hacked down on him anyway and killed him, then what's next? Do you think that you just turn around and hack at Palpatine and then walk out and go celebrate? No, that's not what's going to happen. If Wanda does continue down this path, those children won't love her. Those children will fear her. And that's what she finally realizes, is that you cannot force these things. You cannot bend things to be the way you want them to be, which, to tie it all the way back to Anakin, is what he proposes to Padme. We can make them the way, you know, things the way we want them to be. Like, I don't know, rule the galaxy. Like, control is a false promise. You have to be willing to give it up. And every single Steven, whether it's Defender Strange, even the greatest Strange, Supreme Strange from 838, the Illuminati, even him, the one who was able to defeat Thanos, was only able to do so by surrendering to the Darkhold, by dreamwalking. And even at his highest heights, he was doing that. And it takes, and of course, in Sinister Strange, takes that to its furthest extreme, where he starts killing other strangers. He has that great line of, you ever feel like you're falling in a dream? That was probably me. Like that. Now he's reached out to other places and he's trying to control everything. And it's turned him into this ghoul. And there is a little bit of that, in the same way that Luke carries that experience of the robot hands and of that darkness with him for the rest of his days, all the way to the, you know, very controversial and often misunderstood scene in Ben's hut in the flashbacks of Last Jedi, he's still carrying that with him. In the same way that we see this film, Multiverse of Madness, ends with Strange having a third eye. It's like, yeah, you won, but you did touch darkness to do it.
Yeah.
You did dreamwalk, and you did like dreamwalk plus. You did the worst dreamwalk that you could possibly do into a corpse. So you don't leave unscathed. You know, to bring up another myth, you look at Lord of the Rings. You know, that's why Frodo has to leave. That's the that's the burden of those heroes. You don't just get to have the moment of, well, we won. Like, no, normal people can kind of do that. You know, people like Nine Nub, you know, people that are not as mythical.
R.I.P.
Yeah, he had great retirement decades. You know, but heroes that are at the forefront, you don't really get that. And so I think that Wanda, to tie it all the way back in with your parallel, Wanda has that moment when she sees those kids crying. I almost, in the theater, I don't know if you have this, I almost expected Paul Bettany to have a surprise appearance and him to run down the stairs and be like, get away from my children. Like, I thought they were going to go that far. You didn't need to. But she has that moment of, oh my God, like, if I continue down this path, even if I do take over as their mother, we're never going to have a pure moment.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. You sound like there are like eight things I need to respond to what you said there, because it's all so good and so meaty.
Please.
But like, you know, on the one hand, you know, you talked about that idea of surrender. And I think you kind of see that particularly in Anakin's final moments in Jedi, like when they're on the ramp to the Imperial shuttle and he tells them, takes the mask off and he says, but you'll die. And then he says, nothing can stop that now. And like, that's such a kind of evolution for Anakin, where his path to the dark side was saying, I'll become the most powerful Jedi ever. I'll even figure out how to stop people from dying. Mm-hmm. And then one of the defining moments of his return to the light is that surrender and saying, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. You can't stop that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that kind of surrender there. And you know, that notion, you know, to go back to that notion of the third way, both Luke finding the third way and I think Strange finding the third way, I think in his context, for his character, I think that kind of really represents a kind of evolution for him. And I think it's particularly, I think, a way that you can see the kind of effect and the consequence of, like, let's say his arc in No Way Home, where you have, I think it is, I can't remember the exact line, but in that opening scene of Multiverse of Madness, when you get the Defender Strange and he's sucking the power out of America Chavez, I think he says the same line that Strange does in No Way Home about, in the grand calculus of the multiverse, your sacrifice is acceptable. Again, I don't remember the exact phrase.
I might have it wrong too, but I believe it's grand calculus multiverse, your death means more than your life, or...
Yeah, your sacrifice means infinitely more than your survival or your life.
But it is the same line. You're right. It is the same
line. And it's the same thing that he tells Peter about the villains. Mm-hmm. When Peter starts saying, like, no, we can save them. And Strange is like, no, their fate is to die. We need to allow that to happen in order for to restore peace of the multiverse. And then it's Peter in that story where he's like, no, I got the third way. And we're going to get them back. We're going to fix everything. But also, I am going to fix them so that they don't die to Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And so I think there you can draw a line and say, and make the case that, okay, maybe that is, maybe the way that he deals with America and Multiverse of Madness is him maybe taking in some of that, learning some of that.
Yeah.
That, like, there is this third option.
Yeah, and that has to come from the finally, unlike the other Strangers, accepting that it doesn't all fall on him, that he can allow himself to be fallible, that he can allow himself to not know, that he can allow himself to fail, that he can allow himself to do the wrong thing. And there's a great, wonderful connection to the first film, where in the first film, Doctor Strange has the watch that he got from Christine that the glass is shattered and he leaves it that way, which, you know, I always interpret it to represent this idea of some things can't be fixed, whether that's his life situation, his hands, his status, his career, that things change and they stay changed. But then he does change the glass in the second one, and he is able to repair it and bring it back to a state of newness. But it's only through letting go can you fix it with a new piece of glass, with a new layer. Christine does get married. He tells her, I love you in every universe, but he does not, you know, quote unquote, get the girl. He's able to fix that watch by accepting that, you know, things do change, but you can also have new beginnings, but you have to allow them to be new beginnings. You can't keep trying to repair.
Yeah. And, you know, back to the point where you were talking about the burdens of the heroes and how they have to carry these scars around. You use the great example of Frodo in Lord of the Rings, and also with Luke, and, you know, and the notion of the way that he kind of carries some of the flaws or repeats some of the mistakes. Like, you brought up the great example of Ben Solo. Like, I've talked about on this show before, and I've talked about in other contexts, about the way that you can take Luke's narration of what happens in the hut, his kind of the second version of his story, not the first version, but the second version, and you can take almost word for word and you can just graft it onto what happens at the end of Jedi, where he talks about, like, I sensed the fear, the anger, the death of everything that I love, and for the briefest moment of pure instinct, I thought I could stop it. It passed like a fleeting shadow, and I was left with shame and with consequence. That's the confrontation with Vader. And, you know, I've seen so many people, like, there's so many people who sort of critique Luke's actions there with Ben and saying, like, well, doesn't that kind of undo the end of Jedi? Because didn't he kind of learn that whole lesson with Vader? And I always, like, my response to that, like, is like, if only we learned these lessons once.
Exactly.
Like, life would be so much easier if we make the one mistake and we're like, okay, and then you just never do it again. No.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of threat is the dark side mythically or thematically if it can be overcome once?
Yeah.
That's not a threat. That's not compelling.
Yeah.
There's no dramatic tension there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there are, all of us have aspects of ourselves, things within our personality or mentality where we just kind of keep, there are things that we keep coming back to over and over. The context may change, the triggers may change, but we circle back to them. It's like, you know, when you get Yoda's conversation with Luke in front of the tree in Octo, when he's like, young Skywalker, still looking to the horizon. That's what Yoda's getting to there. He's like, you're still that kid. You still got those mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Never right in front of your nose.
Yeah. Like, I like that idea because I think the fact that, yeah, sure, on the one hand, Luke does learn an important lesson there. And he kind of brings it back when he tells Leia, no one's ever really gone. But it's like, yeah, like the fact that you learn the lesson once, even if it's in a very profound and important moment, doesn't necessarily mean that you won't confront the same issue again and that you won't stumble again. And again, that's something you can connect with in the context of Wanda. Like, that's an example of, yeah, she goes through the experience in WandaVision of what happens in Westview. And then she realizes the error of her ways there. But then it's like, yeah, but then there are still those seedlings, those aspects of her character that make it possible to make similar mistakes again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we see so often in our heroes. It's one of those things that I love as a through line of Luke, where he at multiple points has the experience of, he's starting from a good place. He wants to save the people that he loves. But then it kind of veers him in the wrong direction. It veers him to the kind of quick and easy instinctual decision that has all these consequences.
Yeah, it's the curse. It's the curse of heroes in Star Wars. And a lot of the times it ends up being the curse of just mythological heroes overall, whether that's Doctor Strange, whether that's Wanda Maximoff, even, you know, bringing that MCU cast to the forefront. I mean, that's Tony Stark, you know, the guy that built the MCU. It's all built on good intentions.
Yeah, exactly. And so then, you know, we've kind of talked about Ben, that's now we've segued into the sequel trilogy period. And, you know, we've talked already a little bit. We've sort of touched a little bit on the rise of Skywalker of it all, but I do want to kind of circle back to it and talk about it more fully, because I think that movie, like with his plot, with all the stuff on Exegol, like I think it is, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think it is this really important thematic through line to the movie. Because on the one hand, there is, in that opening scene when Kylo arrives on Exegol, there are the kind of literal surface callbacks, the dark side is a pathway to many abilities, some consider to be unnatural, the repetition. But I think there is also the thematic ones, because you do get, the power to create life and cheat death, that's in there. I made Snoke.
Mm-hmm.
I have died before. There is all that. But then there is that also that thematic through line of confronting the darkness and of confronting the temptation. Because Palpatine is this symbol of temptation. And you see that in the conversation with Kylo when he says, the First Order was just the beginning. I can give you so much more. Like, what can you give me? Everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the ideas for Kylo Ren of significance, of wanting to be his own person, of wanting to have, once again, control. Control of what? His life. Control, finally, of his identity. And that, I think, intimately ties in with what Wanda and Strange are both going through. Strange has this knowledge now, firsthand knowledge that he has witnessed and has been told by Charles Xavier and the other Illuminati members of, you're way more of a problem. We're way more concerned about you than we are about your witch. And then Wanda is still dealing with what Agatha tells her of, you're this horrible thing. And then Mount Wundagore kind of confirms that you are really this horrible thing. Demons bow to you. There's a whole mountain made for the purposes of your worship in the context of darkness and dark magic and evil. And so it's everybody trying to wrestle for the ability to say, this is who I am. This is who I want to be. This is how I want to conduct my life. But what means, by what means are you willing to get there? And for Kylo Ren, even though his redemption is at the end of the film, for those first two acts, he is embracing this shortcut, which is so key to what Star Wars is.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked a little bit about Ben Solo earlier and about his turn. And like, I think even in his story, you can see the ways in which his turn to darkness is in some ways rooted in something that you can consider positive, because there is this notion of trying to live up to a certain legacy and to kind of carry on what came before you. Because it starts off, of course, in the context of when he's a Jedi of, here's my uncle, Luke Skywalker, this great hero, this legend. I want to be like him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he turns, it becomes, I want to become like what he thinks is his grandfather, Vader.
Yeah.
And living up to that. And then you get, you know, on the one hand, in Last Jedi, you get first the Snoke put down about, like, you're no Vader, you're just a child in a mask. And then at the end, when he does the Son of Darkness, heir apparent to Lord Vader, and then Palpatine kind of drawing that again, like, you know, kill the girl and the Jedi and become what your grandfather Vader could not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that notion of living up to your full potential, to becoming what you can be, the way that kind of gets twisted into become this particular thing. And with Palpatine and his return, like that idea of him kind of tapping into these unnatural powers, like it reminded me, I don't have the exact line here, but there is that line when they're talking about in Multiverse of Madness, when they're talking about dreamwalking. And I think it is, maybe it's Mordo. I think the alternate universe Mordo, when he describes it as this kind of forbidden, like the most forbidden, corrupted power. Again, it's something like that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of paraphrasing. And you kind of see that with Palpatine. He is kind of tapped into this, he has kind of broken the laws of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like he has violated the laws of the Force in this way. Like he has bent it to his will to survive.
Which comes in with the themes of hypocrisy with Wanda. She points it out at the beginning of the movie that you break the rules and you're a hero. I break them and I'm the bad guy. And then at the end, Steven proves her right, because he does need to go to that place to be able to confront her. There's no way around that. That's something that he'll have to live with. he'll have to live with it when he's brushing his teeth in the morning and he sees a third eye. Like, yeah. That's a sign, like, yeah, she had a point. And that's something you have to consider. And it goes all the way back to 616 Mordo in the first film of the bill comes due with everything that you've done. You know, you've mm-hmm. broken the sacred purpose of the magic that we wield.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with Palpatine, you know, once he sort of turns his mission away from the kind of grooming of Kylo to take his place to ultimately to his plan B, which is Rey, you know, you see on the one hand, I think there's a couple of these threads that we've kind of talked about all the way through this conversation, where there's on the one hand, there's the whole, as you mentioned, the Zori line about they win by making you think you're alone. Like, he tries to do that with Rey. He tries to isolate her. He tries to put her in that box of the fact that she has no choice. Like, it's in your blood, our blood. Like, you are Empress Palpatine. Like, this is your destiny to take this throne and to lead the Sith.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was that notion of helping, of like trying to, you know, go from a standpoint of good intentions, which is it's the only way that you can save your friends is by taking the throne and taking command of this army.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting there because, you know, to kind of look at some of the connections earlier on, and again, the ways that other stories in Star Wars inform what's happening here. There's a really interesting moment where, like, you can see that Palpatine in the way that he confronts Rey, like, that he thinks he's learned from his failure with Luke, because he has that conversation. He has that line where he says, "Your master, Luke Skywalker, was saved by his father. The only family you have here is me." So, you know, back when he's on the Death Star 2, he of course fails to anticipate the return of Anakin and the fact that Anakin would come back to the light and then ultimately destroy him. And from that, like, you can see, like, Rise of Skywalker Palpatine thing, like, okay, I didn't see that coming. My bad. That didn't work out. But now, haha, I figured it out. Right. I'm the only family member here. There's no one coming to save her. Like, I got her now.
Yep. Yep. It's always wanting people to buy into the easiest narrative, you know, the narrative of the dark side. He wants her to turn toward the easy answers as Anakin did. He wants her to come to believe this falsehood that you're defined by what other voices say you are. Much like, you know, like we mentioned with Wanda, and it's her deciding that she's going to control her own narrative through defense and not attack. You know, she's able to do sort of what Kylo Ren can't at the beginning of the film. She doesn't take a shortcut. You know, there is no shortcut there in standing firm against him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, so much of that movie is, I mean, this is a kind of truism about Star Wars more broadly, but, like, so much of that movie is about the kind of dichotomy of choice and inevitability, where Rey is, in two different contexts, in the context of both Kylo and then ultimately Palpatine, being put in this position of saying, well, because of your lineage, because of who your grandfather is, you are therefore kind of predetermined to this certain end, where mm-hmm. where Kylo has a line on the Death Star wreckage where he talks about the dark side of the Force is in our nature.
Yep.
And then Palpatine, of course, tries to replicate the same act with the Empress Palpatine. It's in your blood, our blood. And then it is Rey making the realization, the understanding of choice, of agency, of the other path out, which is that she can reject her lineage. She can embrace the Skywalker lineage. And that, so making that, again, tying her back to Luke, tying her back to these other heroes, which is that notion of choice, of the other path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, you sort of touch on, like, I also kind of like, this was another thing that I kind of occurred to me in the theater. I was watching it, like, you know, you brought up the Mount Wandagora. There is, of course, the kind of that parallel with the Exegol parallel, which is, like, it's this kind of, it's the Genesis site of where the evil has spawned.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's whatever version of it you want to you know, you want to find in myth or in classic stuff. Like, it's hell. It's Hades. It is the last circle. I mean, this is the place that is pure, where this evil can thrive, where there aren't any of your allies. Your allies couldn't break through with you. They're out on the threshold, holding the line, and it has to be you. And without being able to open herself up to the voices of the Jedi past to remind herself of the light, there would be none there.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of goes back to, I think, a point that you made not too long ago about needing to confront evil at its kind of root, at its kind of wellspring. Like, that's what happened there. In order to deliver the final death knell blow to the Sith, you have to go to their heart, their beating heart.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go to this place and confront it there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's ultimately what has to happen in Multiverse of Madness, which is like the evil has to be defeated in the place from whence it came. From this temple, like, that has to be destroyed.
Yeah. And not
in order for this threat to be gone.
Not through attack, you know, because even though Luke Skywalker's victory in Return of the Jedi is key and powerful and beautiful, it does come through actively fighting,
mm-hmm.
At least, you know, a portion of it. Whereas Rey does not. She does not actively fight Palpatine. She only defends herself. She only refuses to be afraid, refusing to hate. Once again, finding a third option, a fourth option, you know, once building on Luke's victory, and taking that to its highest height.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm glad you sort of like emphasized that point with Rey about the purely defensiveness of it all, because I've seen like some takes and interpretations, particularly with their defeat of Palpatine, has tried to cast it as a kind of offensive maneuver, which I've never sort of seen it as. And even when she's fighting like the Royal Guard and stuff, the way that she's just kind of deflecting their bolts back at them rather than outwardly attacking them. Yeah. I think it is coming from that place of knowledge and defense, never attack.
Yeah. I have seen stuff like that too, of, you know, she blasted him away. It's like, no, he blasted him away through his hubris and his arrogance and his refusal to stop. And yeah, I mean, after her defeat of Kylo and then healing of Kylo on Kef Beer, Rey does not take an offensive maneuver for the entire duration of the rest of the film. She never swings, ever. She, like, the most she does is, you know, use the Force to trip someone off their feet when they're shooting at her with the Sovereign Protectors. She fully goes into defensive mode for the entire rest of the thing. And that's why I resent the notion that the end of Rise is a repeat of Jedi. It's not. It's an evolution of Jedi.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, it goes to that, again, to that theme of we are what they grow beyond, where Luke, on the one hand, he gets to the kind of Jedi place of not attacking and throwing away the lightsaber and then ultimately getting to that victory. But he has to get there by going through, you know, by coming to the precipice.
Yeah.
And then taking the step back. Whereas Rey can kind of start from there. And she is able to really, throughout that whole confrontation, really able to resist Palpatine. Like, there's not really a moment where she is giving in. Like, even the point where she sort of seemingly goes along with the ritual and is going to strike him down, like, I don't think she was ever realistically going to do it.
No, I think that, you know, she was at that point, she's just sort of, it's a combination of buying time and having faith at that moment.
Yeah. So there is that idea of, we are what they grow beyond. Like, she is sort of, she is, as you said, like, she's doing what Luke did, but then also elevating beyond that and becoming greater than that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And so, you know, I think one of the kind of morals that I think we see through all of these stories that we talked about in the context, particularly of Star Wars, but then also the connections back to Doctor Strange, with all of these different heroes, and there's, you know, there's other examples that we could have brought up in this conversation that we did get into of this idea of temptation, is that I think one of the morals, and I think one of the takeaways that you can see from all of these stories, like one of the through lines, is that, and I said this in another context, which is that, as Yoda says in Empire, the dark side of the Force is not stronger. It is, however, powerful, and it would not be tempting if it weren't.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like, yes, you can use the dark side to do very powerful and nature bending and breaking things, whether that is the Force lightning, whether that is saving yourself when you are, you've been cut down and you're burnt to a crisp and you can stay alive, or you've been cut in half,
right,
and you're on the garbage planet. You can stay alive, or you've gotten blown up in a reactor core.
Yeah.
Subtle. And it's, yes. And like, that is the root of the temptation, is that, yes, it ultimately does have these consequences and it is not stronger than light, but mm-hmm. it is powerful. You can use it for all of these things. Yeah. And that is what our heroes time and time again have to confront.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I mean, it's the, that's why it requires them to dig into their souls and find those other solutions, because the other side solutions are very readily available, but they're not readily sustainable.
Yeah, exactly. And that is why, you know, there is that, there's that, that skier line in the High Republic. I don't remember. I don't think it's in Light of the Jedi. I think it's in one of the other books where he talks about how being on the, like, the choice to be on the light is this choice you have to make every time,
mm-hmm.
like constantly.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of, you know, one of the things that, that Star Wars, like one of the lessons of Star Wars, and particularly, I think one of the lessons that kind of the sequel trilogy has imparted, which is that, like, there is no ultimate victory.
No, it, I mean, and that's Qui-Gon too. Turn toward the yeah. light because it's there.
Yes.
You constantly have to make that choice.
Yeah. It's a choice you have to make all the time. The darkness is a threat that always comes back. You sort of talked about that earlier with how, like, the darkness has different faces or kind of different outward appearances, but it's the same. It goes back to that Maz Kanata line in The Force Awakens, where she said, oh, the Sith, the Empire, now it's the First Order, but it's the same threat.
Mm-hmm.
It's just had different names.
Yeah. And they all fancy themselves to be different.
Mm-hmm.
But they're in denial. You know, they're in denial about a futile quest.
Yeah, exactly. And so the need on the one hand to constantly face these threats, the fact that you can't get this kind of ultimate victory that you can get, you know, as Luke says in Last Jedi, there was balance for a time and then the balance got thrown off. And then it's got to be, as Anakin says to Rey, bring back the balance as I did. Mm-hmm. That a constant repetition. And so the need to, again, constantly confront the darkness and then to constantly choose the light right. every time. Like, that is the struggle. And yeah, I think that's a kind of good place to wrap up the conversation, unless you have sort of additional thoughts on anything that we've talked about or examples or kind of story points that we didn't bring up.
My additional thought is that Multiverse of Madness is good. And I will hear no slander. No, I'm kidding. I just think it's a very, very, very stylized film intentionally. I mean, it's Raimi, but it has so much to say, so much to connect to the overall themes of heroism in general. And it doesn't have a cut and dry villain, just like how Vader is not a cut and dry villain. And these things all yeah. sort of, they're there to challenge. They're there to ask questions in this morality play and to ask people, particularly these younger audiences that are going to be watching the movies, what is the right path? And I think that it handles it in an operatic and exciting way.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I like your, you know, to your point about saying that, like, there's no clear villain. Like, I think it's one of those stories where the people who are, let's say, positioned in the kind of, in a kind of villain-esque role or are in kind of an antagonistic position, like someone like a Wanda, like they are in a way, and again, that kind of gets to like, that's a similarity to some of our Star Wars villains. So like somebody like a Vader, like they are in a way kind of avatar for the larger threat. Like they are personification, they are a manifestation of the kind of larger, the actual kind of larger villain or larger enemy.
Yeah. I mean,
whether it is a kind of darkness, a temptation.
They're cautionary tales, and they are, like you said, the avatars, they're like a physical representation of like, this is what happens. You know, that's how you get, you know, it's too late for me, son. Like, it's that type of moment. And we'll see sort of if Wanda can have maybe a similar reckoning with her own children down the road. If it is the 838 versions, who knows how they end up handling that. But it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. And it'll be really interesting to see where Strange goes. Because of course we get what we haven't touched on yet is the post-credit scene, or the mid-credit scene rather. Because the post-credit scene is just the guy punching himself. But the mid-credit scene of the sorceress Clea. Is that? Yeah.
Yes,
I'm assuming that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her coming through and telling him that his actions have created this incursion, and the two of them going into the dark dimension, and you see the third eye popping out. So then there's that kind of question of, okay, where's his story going to be going? Is he now going to take a darker turn? Like, he's left, that movie leaves Strange in this kind of liminal state. And I think, of course, you know, to situate that story within kind of the broader direction that Phase 4 is going, like, it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, because there's all these threads. You've got on the one hand the Strange thread of, oh, he's, you know, through his actions, through kind of saving America and defeating Wanda, he's created this incursion that's got to get fixed. Then you have like the Loki stuff and, you know, whatever like he and Sylvie have been doing with the timeline. And so there's all of this different, there's all these kind of chaotic threads. And then there's the question of like, how are they all going to ultimately intersect?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really interesting balance of how he's going to have to deal with the consequences of so much. But again, it's always the really, really, really human core, which is so exciting.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think we can ramp up this conversation there. Just like with the first one, you know, I had no doubts that this was going to be a great conversation, and it was that and then some.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is much fun. I love that you do these types of the connection ones, because sometimes it's easy, and B, it's for us anyway, to talk about pop culture in terms of pop culture, like to see things so mythically, like no spoilers. And I think we're still embargoed for Shadow of the Sith. But it's no secret that it's Lord of the Rings inspired with some of the stuff that happens there. And it's just so easy to bounce in between the worlds and just to find the parallels, because it's so iterative. You know, that's what Star Wars is. It is every great story ever told.
Exactly.
And that's why, and filmmakers now, most of them will cite it as an influence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is one of the, I guess you could, you know, from a certain point of view, it is both a gift and a curse in certain contexts, which is that even when consuming non-Star Wars media, my Star Wars brain, I think this is probably the case with you and a lot of other people who do what we do, which is our Star Wars brains never turn off. Mm-hmm. So, or it's very hard to do that. And so, you know, you're sitting in a movie theater and you're watching something like Multiverse of Madness, and then all of a sudden you're going like, oh, like, that's Anakin, that's Exegol, that's Palpatine, that's all of this.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it comes from a place of, as you just mentioned, it comes from that kind of Joseph Campbell idea of like, all of these stories are telling the same story. That's simplification, but yeah, it's this idea of like, there are these kind of archetypes and motifs that are foundational to so many of these stories. And as a consequence, it is possible to put these stories into conversation with one another and see the themes that run through, to see the character journeys that go through, to see the struggles and how they're similar.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and it's why I love doing these kinds of episodes. So, yeah, and so I'm really, really glad that you decided to agree to come back on a talk, because again, like I think I said this at the end of the first episode, like your voice and your perspective is one of these in our space that I really, really value.
Thank you, man. And I appreciate that.
And so any chance that I get to, you know, to either talk to you or just hear you in other contexts talking about Star Wars, non-Star Wars things, the way that non-Star Wars things connect to Star Wars is always, you know, is always something I treasure. So
thanks, man.
I'm happy
to be here. Happy to be able to break this stuff down with you. And to, you know, if anyone finishes up an episode like this and starts watching things differently, then whether they agree or not, just the fact that they thought about it, you know, is good for the space, good for us, good for everyone.
Yeah, that's always my goal for doing these sorts of things, particularly for having guests on, is there is, on the one hand, there's the desire for, you know, to have those listening get some new perspective. Again, as you said, even if they don't agree with it, even if it's not the way that they interpret things, to really say, oh, okay, here's a reading of this that is plausible. But then there is the kind of selfish motivation that invariably I have, which is like, I want to suck in the stuff too for myself. I want to learn. Like I want to get the perspective. Like I want my own view to change and to be expanded. So I'm glad I get to, you know, to do both of them, to kind of kill two birds with one stone. I can get you, the listener, your perspective, your horizon can be broadened, but then also like my own brain can be fed.
100%. Well said.
And so, yeah. So to kind of wrap up, let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, so you can find me talking Star Wars on Octo Radio, Star Wars Podcast, AHCHTO Radio, wherever you get your podcasts. That's my show. The main show, there's also a Rewatch Between Worlds on there where we're going through Star Wars Rebels with myself and Nikki Kumar. Tori Fox's show, The Mandalorian Creed, is there. Hers is seasonal, so she has four seasons that are up now that you can check out. And then I'm also on the One and Done Film Club podcast. I pop up around the space doing collaborations with other people, doing writing Star Wars Twitter threads, talking about, I don't know, wrestling, Dua Lipa, all that good stuff. Find me on Twitter at that Alden Diaz, thatalden diaz.
Awesome. Well, Alden, thanks again for coming back on the show.
Thanks so much, man.
So what to expect on the next episode? Episode 39 will drop on July 11th. And on that episode, I'll be taking a look back at Obi-Wan Kenobi, the 6-part limited series, and diving deep into the story that we get there and the ways that that limited series has informed our understanding of Obi-Wan, of Vader, of Leia, and the kind of larger Star Wars story and where it kind of fits into all of that. So I am excited to do that. I'm especially excited because I will be breaking down the show with a very special guest. So joining me for the Obi-Wan Kenobi conversation will be the one and only Kelly Knox. So I am super, super excited to have her on the show and to get to hear her take on Obi-Wan Kenobi, both the show and also the man, because she has literally written a book on Obi-Wan Kenobi. So that will no doubt be a most excellent conversation. So do look for that. Until then, make sure you're subscribed to the show. Please rate and review the show if you are able to do so. If you're not already following the show on Twitter, you can do so at A Larger View Pod. And until next time, look for the Force, and you will always find me.